This is Christine Gordon reporting in Juneau, Alaska, with Rosita Worrell, the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
Yadeklatak kakahani yukatuasak, jakna ayachat, shangu kwedi ayachat, tukahadi yadi dachank ayachat, kaudliyai hit ayachat, jushkat kwan ayachat. That's who I am in Tlingit. My Tlingit name is Kahani, and it comes from a historical event about going into the interior to trade. My other name, Yadeklazak, is an ancient name. The meaning has been lost. I am an eagle from the Thunderbird House, and I'm also from the house lowered from the sun. And I am a child of the Tlukahadi, and I am a Chokat. I'm a Tlingit from the Haines and Klukwan area. In English, I'm Rosita Worrell, and I am the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
Dr. Worrell, what is the mission of the Institute?
As envisioned by our elders, it's to preserve and perpetuate Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian cultures. But we've gone beyond, and we've added new goals. Those are to promote cross-cultural understanding and to support cultural diversity. Because in doing our work to preserve and enhance our language and culture, we've realized that we also have to educate the outside world about the significance and importance of our culture. Because as we know, it was those outside forces in not understanding about our culture, they work to suppress our culture. So right now we expend a lot of energies trying to educate, you know, the public about our languages and cultures.
What kind of things are taking place here at the Institute in order to meet that goal?
Initially, when Sea Alaska Heritage was formed, the work was primarily in preservation. And so in the early years, under the leadership of David Katzik, you saw the great works of Dick and Nora Dauenhauer, their publications of oral traditions. So there was a lot of recording of oral traditions and then publicizing them. But about 17 years ago, one of the trustees and myself were at a conference in Anchorage, and we were introduced to four Hawaiian ladies who showed us the progress that they were having in the restoration of Hawaiian language. So we came back, and the Board of Trustees adopted the restoration of our languages as our highest priority. We decided that it was important for the board to see what could be accomplished. And so the Board of Trustees went to Hawaii. And I will tell you, the Hawaiian language was, I hate to use the word moribund. It's a word that linguists use to describe death-bound languages. Mm-hmm. We actually forbid the use of that word to describe our languages. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we went to Hawaii, and we saw little children speaking the language. And I will tell you that our trustees cried, mm-hmm. you know, when they saw that. Mm-hmm. And so many of them were older and had gone through periods of, you know, suppression. Our chair talks about, you know, the suffering she went through in going to school, having her mouth, you know, washed out. And I don't know if you saw very recently on one of our Facebooks, somebody brought us in a bar of Fel Snaffa soap, and that soap has lye in it. But that soap was used to wash out the mouths of our grandparents when they would go to school. And you know how lethal that is, or how, you know, people's mouths would get all raw from it. So there was a lot of trauma inflicted on our grandparents and elders.
Why was this taking place? Why was this suppression taking place? And from what I've heard, it was happening mostly with the Protestant missionaries, more so than the Catholic missionaries. So some parts of Alaska and some cultures were more affected than others. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, first of all, we can't just blame the Christians alone.
Why not?
Yeah. Because it was part of public policy. And very early, our government decided that it was important to detribalize or to civilize and then Christianize these pagan people that they encountered. And so you saw the establishment of schools, and there actually there are historical records where the Bureau of Indian Affairs is recording how many children are learning English. So it really started off with public policy. And in Alaska, the federal government supported missionaries to take over the schools initially. And so Sheldon Jackson, a Presbyterian minister, came to Southeast Alaska, supported by the federal government, and began his process of civilizing and Christianizing Alaska Natives. And the churches got together, and they actually divided up Alaska among themselves. And so I think in Southeast, we had the Presbyterians, other regions of Alaska had the Moravians, and they actually divided up Alaska among the different denominations. And so they went through the process of trying to teach English.
And you have a personal story. I mean, basically, from my understanding, what happened in many cases was that children would be taken from their parents
yes.
and sent off
yes.
miles away
right.
in order to teach them English and to get them out of their communities.
Right. Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I wasn't able to talk about it before, but I think it's really important that people know that these things happen to living individuals. And I, as a six-year-old in Petersburg, even though I'm from the Haines, Clukwan area, our family had gone down to Petersburg. I think our grandfather was a boat builder or something like that, and the opportunities were there. Anyway, one of the other things that happens is very often a child is given to grandparents. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our social security system where, you know, they bond with the grandparents. And it means that in later life, grandparents will have a grandchild that would be able to take care of them. So I always say that's part of our social security system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was living with grandparents, and my grandparents actually didn't want me to go to school. And my sister went to school. I didn't have to go to school, so I'd have lots of fun, you know, playing. And I remember I'd bring kids over to the house, and I'd say, "You want to see magic?" And I would get a bar of soap, and I'd stuff, lather it, and I'd say, look at magic, you know. And then I remember one of the other things was pansies. I'd tell them, come, I'm going to show you magic. And I'd plant the seeds, and the kids would come and look and watch it grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I was living really well. I had mm-hmm. a lot of fun.
Freedom.
And then along comes a welfare lady
mm-hmm.
and said, and at the time, I didn't know what her objective was, but she asked me, "Do you want to see your brother?" And I said, "Of course, I want to see my brother." But I didn't know what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we were driving past Omer's Cannery, I remember the cab driver saying, "Shouldn't we stop by and tell the grandparents that you're taking her?"
Mm-hmm.
And I remember distinctly the welfare lady say, "No, drive on."
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I began to realize there was something amiss.
Mm-hmm.
And we got down to the float plane, and I was actually trying to fight, you know, to break away from the welfare lady. But as a six-year-old, I wasn't able to overcome the welfare lady and the pilot and the other person who was there. And I recall being kind of literally thrown in the back of the plane like a piece of luggage. I know I was so frightened, and I know I wet my pants, you know. It was a horrible, you know. I didn't know what was going on. And then we came to Juneau, and I guess there was a number of other children that they were taking up to Haines' house, and it was aboard the Princeton Hall. And I remember, you know, just really not knowing what was going on. And a number of years ago, when I was attending the Alaska Federation of Natives meeting in Fairbanks, this individual came up to me, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I looked at him, and I said, "No." And he says, "Well, I remember you." He says, "I remember you when they were taking you from Juneau to Haines' house." And he said, you had been crying and crying. And he said, "You were going..." And the missionaries would say, stop crying. And, you know, he thought it was really cruel. I've always wanted to host a get together of a lot of us who went, you know, who were taken to those schools. But it actually took my mother 3 years to get me out of that Haines House. And Haines House, I don't have a lot of great memories about it, you know, mm-hmm. because there was, you know, a lot of physical punishment, hard labor. I mean, 6 years old, and I was, you know, I'd had to make toast. And at that point in time, they were making toast in the oven. So I would have to crawl on the oven door and put the toast in the oven. Then I remember 6 years old, having to stand on a chair to mangle, you know, those big iron, those rolling irons, commercial irons. I'd have to use that to iron sheets. Fortunately, my grandparents got my aunt to come and work in Haines House. And when I was assigned to the laundry room, she wouldn't let me work. She just let me play. Yeah, so that was, you know, experience in Haines.
The man that came up to you, that was the cab driver?
No, the man, he was an older boy. Mm-hmm. He was also going to Haines, but he says he distinctly remembers, you know, me as a 6 year old crying.
And they told you your brother would be there? Was your brother there?
My brother wasn't there, you know.
So that was a trick.
Yeah, it was a trick. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there they obviously no one was speaking your own language. Everyone's speaking English, and you're learning English. And was it to pull you out of the environment to get you Anglified?
Remember, the mission is to civilize and Christianize the Indian. Take out all the tribal attributes, the tribal values, the tribal behaviors. And so there were, you know, I wasn't alone. There was many, many other children who were there who were punished. Mm-hmm. And I mean punished, you know, physical punishment. Today they would call it child abuse.
You mean like hitting and slapping?
Yes, and I mean, and hard labor, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I was 6 years old, and I remember scrubbing, you know, being on my hands and knees and scrubbing what I thought was a really long haul, you know. And it was sad. At nighttime, you would hear children crying. You know, I wasn't the only one. But you'd be hearing children sobbing, you know, just wondering, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm.
So you were there until what age?
I was there for at least 3 years, maybe four, because I went there when I was six. And it took my mother, it took her over 3 years to get me out of that school. And the other thing I want to note is that when I say mother, in Tlingit style, in Tlingit tradition, sisters are, and their offsprings, the offsprings view the mothers, their mother and the aunts as mothers. So when I say my mother, she was my Tlingit mother, not my biological mother, because my biological mother had died. But to me, she was my mother, and it took her 3 years to get me out of that home.
How do you think language and culture are tied together in your particular life?
Well, this is where I will tell you that I differ from anthropologists, and I am an anthropologist. I'm a trained anthropologist. But anthropologists will tell you that once your language is gone, your culture is gone. I've worked to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so they are intertwined, definitely. And languages do convey the knowledge of a culture. It conveys the knowledge that you have all about the world, about the environment, about relationships to the environment. It does hold your knowledge. It does hold that, you know, that ancient knowledge of the culture.
Can you give us some specifics that that English people wouldn't be used to knowing?
Well, I like to tell the story that David Katzik is a clan leader, very respected elder in our society. And he always says to me, Rosita, I get so mad about the simplicity of English. And he says, for example, when you say a fish jumps, the fish jumps. And we do put it in our dictionaries, a fish jumps. And he says, but it doesn't tell the full meaning of it. He says, when a fish emerges from the water, you'll hear, you know, the sound of the water breaking. You'll feel the spray or see the spray of the water. And then you'll feel the, you know, you see or feel the fish, you know, reemerging. So that's just one word. And if you can imagine, you know, and we have really some really good discussions about, you know, what does this mean?
So what happened 3 years ago leading up to the legislation to protect, or is it simply to recognize is it 20 languages?
Yes.
Plus English.
Okay. I would say that legislation was a very symbolic event in that it recognized that we had indigenous languages. But I don't know if you remember a few years prior to that, the legislature was going for English only. Remember? I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was an important event in terms of the symbolic recognition of native languages. But what did it do in terms of language restoration? I have to go back to about, you know, that time, mm-hmm. 17 years ago, when we went to Anchorage and we saw those Hawaiians and learned about their teaching methods. So that's when I talk about language restoration beginning, language restoration and revitalization. And the first thing that we had to do was that we had to convince our elders that it's okay to speak your native language. And if you remember that they were raised in periods where language was to be suppressed, and they were taught that if you want your child to succeed, then your child must learn English. And so, of course, what parent doesn't want his child to succeed? So they were taught English. And I remember the story of Marsha Hutch from Klukwan. She wrote that, you know, when she started school, she only spoke Tlingit. And the teachers came to her parents' house and said, you have got to speak English to her. Of course, they didn't speak English very well, and so they didn't speak to her. And so she said she would hide under the table at night just to hear them talk Tlingit, just to hear their voices, because they just didn't talk to her. Mm. And because they wanted her to, they thought they were hindering her. So we had to convince our elders that it was okay. So we started the Kustii camp out at the University of Alaska Southeast. Mm. And we actually had something like 250 elders that went through those camps where we were trying to tell them it's okay, speak Tlingit to the children. But we were also trying to show them the university is a good place. You should feel comfortable here. It's okay for you to send your children here. So that was kind of the other message that we were trying to convey. But at the same time, what happened was that, I started that. And when I first started the classes at the university, I had speakers who were the teachers. And I don't know what happened. There was some little misunderstanding. And then the two ladies that were there supposed to be teaching, they left. And so I ended up having to take over the class. And I have to tell you that my Tlingit is very limited. Mm. And we have a whole class of people like myself who are what we call dormant speakers. They can understand the language, but their verbalization is very poor. But what we do know is that it can be restored when they're in a setting where they're hearing nothing but Tlingit. And we've seen that, you know, with individuals. And we appointed our first person to a council of traditional scholars who didn't understand Tlingit. I mean, who didn't speak Tlingit, but he understood it. And so our scholars all speak Tlingit, and they were speaking, and he just sat there and smiled the whole time. And I said, Dad, what's going on? And he was so happy. He says, I can understand them. So now he's one of the teachers up in Yakutat. we started the program, and it was, it seemed like it was going really well. And then I kept saying to myself, what next? And this is something, I know it might sound strange to people, but to me, I always feel like our ancestors have been guiding us here at SHI. I feel like they're the ones who are showing us the way of what we need to do. And I was sitting in my office, and we were over there at Sealaska at that time, and I kept saying, now what am I going to do? And in comes this Roy Mitchell. I had read about him, and he had been teaching up in Barrow. He would teaching, and he was using this method called total physical response. And he came into my office looking for a job, and I felt so happy, and I said, oh, you're exactly what we need. Because what we knew was that the old style of teaching memorization didn't work. You had very little luck with that. So Roy introduced us to this new teaching method called total physical response. And basically what it is that you're learning light languages like a child learns the language. You're moving, you're doing things, you're embedding that language in you through action. So anyway, I will tell you that it's been an experience. We've learned a lot. What I found out was that linguists don't always know the way to teach languages, although the newly trained linguists are familiar with language restoration methods. But the older linguists or classic linguists, they like to study languages. And I have no problems with studying the languages, but studying languages does not yield to restoration. And I ended up with 5 linguists, and I ended up getting rid of all of them because they like to study the language. And pretty soon I noticed that the grants that we were getting were to study the language. And I said, good luck. You know, I support you on that, but this is not our mission. Mm-hmm. Our mission is to restore languages. And we always say, you'll never save the language and culture from Sealaska Plaza 1. It has to be community-based. And so we support, you know, different communities in their language efforts.
So what's going to be happening in the next 5 years?
Well, right now our priority is on really trying to learn as much as we can from the speakers. We have about 100 or more Tlingit language speakers, and they're a vital resource. And so we've established language immersion camps, language immersion teams, where our younger people can be learning from the first language speakers. But the other part of it is that we have to be recording their knowledge. And so we have a lot of tapes that were recorded in Tlingit. So we're doing a lot of transcriptions. We take, first of all, we listen to the language. We transcribe it into Tlingit. And then we translate it into English. And where the first language speakers are important is in that translation. Our language speakers may not know the orthography. They may not know how to spell a word, but they have the understanding and meaning of the word. So when we do the transcriptions, we work with the speakers to translate. Again, you have to go and see some of the work that we're doing where people are working on these translations. And they'll have to go and work with an elder, sometimes 2 elders, or maybe even talk to a number of different individuals to get the full meaning of a word. That's where their knowledge is critical at this point in time. I mean, we can do the orthography, we can transcribe it, but our translations may not have the depth of knowledge without the speakers. So that has to be our priority right now.
And that's to get the full language.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the immersion programs, what are the ages of the children?
Well, right now our priority is with what the people who are called language learners, and that's the name that they gave to themselves. And these are the individuals who are teaching languages in the schools. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I always give credit to the language learners. I know the language learners give credit to the elders and the speakers, but if it were not for the language learners, those individuals who are teachers and who have learned the language and who can get into the schools and teach our children, our language probably would not be at the point where it is right now. You know, I've always said I don't know that we'll ever get to the point where a Tlingit language will be spoken as a first language, although I do know that a number of our language learners who are now having children are speaking to their children in Tlingit. But I think we've made significant progress. I don't know if you've ever gone to any of our dances and seen all of our children who are singing our songs and in the classrooms who are speaking our languages. Mm-hmm. And in some of our villages, people talk about going to the store and hearing younger people speaking our language. Mm-hmm. So we've had progress, you know, and I'm ecstatic about that progress.
I think I heard that it's basically kindergarten age children, and is the hope that this is going to take fire beyond the Tlingit language and all over Alaska?
Yes.
And what is the work that's being done to ignite that?
Well, I mean, we're doing it everywhere. I mean, you know, when people say, what was the priority? And I said, oh, my God, you know, there's so many, you know, you have to approach it at all levels. When we first started, federal government supported language immersion camps, and because that's the best way to learn the language. But we were not ready for language immersion. And so we had to go back and amend the law to support language programs, and then also work to increase the amount of funding that was going into language. So our work is at multiple levels, at the public policy advocacy level, with the legislature trying to get them to recognize our native languages, with the schools trying to get them to integrate them into the schools, educating teachers about the importance of speaking and integrating language and culture into the schools. One of the things that we found, and we know this conclusively, that integrating language and culture into the schools improves the academic standing of our students. And when you improve the academic standing of students, that's good for society. That means that they're going to be able to achieve, you know, a good life. They'll have a quality of life if they can secure good education. So it's good for all of society. So we have to convince that, you know. We have to convince legislators and schools, you know, that it's important to do that. And for the most part, I would say that schools are now recognizing, you know, its significance, its impact on the students, and then consequently on society.
Do you think as a result of the 2014 legislation and also your efforts and everyone's efforts that within the English-speaking high schools, that languages in the region, whatever that language is, will be made a part of the high school as well as with the little ones that are being taught in the immersion programs?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, I see it, you know. I see it in multiple areas, you know, in the high school level. For example, one of the things that we just met with the superintendent of schools here, we want to introduce Native games, Native Youth Olympics. But along in teaching games, we also teach our language. I don't know if you've been to one of our Tlatsin hoop camps, our basketball camps. Mm-hmm. We integrate language into that activity. So you'll be hearing kids running down, Kucheda, Kucheda. You know, they'll be talking in Tlingit. So what we're trying to do is create these language habitats. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of ignoring your question about what was the impact of that legislation. Mm-hmm. That legislation, as I say, was a symbolic gesture. Mm-hmm. It did not provide us any money. Mm-hmm. It did not direct schools to say, you need to be teaching languages. And I don't want to dismiss that legislation. Mm-hmm. It was important in that the state of Alaska, and maybe not all of our society, but we are now recognizing that languages have a place in schools and in our society. I also want to say, you know, like here in Juneau, you know, I know that there's discussions about, you know, using Tlingit names for street names. We're doing more and more about that. So I feel like there's progress, but there's a lot more to be done.
This is Christine Gordon reporting from Juneau, Alaska. for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.